From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Early this morning, the Senate passed a budget resolution after a 15-hour marathon session known as a Votorama. It ended with Vice President Kamala Harris casting her first tie-breaking vote of the Biden administration. Passing the budget measure sets the stage for Democrats to move forward with Biden's coronavirus relief plan without Republican support. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. And Kelsey, walk us through what happened last night in the Senate and into the early morning.
So this whole process known as a Votorama is a normal part of getting a budget passed. And the very first step in using the procedural tool that Democrats want to use to pass the coronavirus aid is passing a budget. Now, that also involves just an endless string of amendments. Basically, any senator can offer basically any amendment as often as they want and as long as they want until they get tired. The thing about it, though, is most of the amendments that get passed are non-binding, meaning that they end up having almost no real impact on whatever legislation is to come. So we went through this long ritual, this long process to set up what will be now the committee work. So all of the committees that are named in this budget resolution will start to get to work on writing an actual COVID relief bill, a thing that could be enacted into law.
And speaking of those amendments, Republicans and even some Democrats have suggested limiting Biden's proposed $1,400 direct checks to a smaller group of people. Are there any details yet about who could be excluded from that relief and what the income threshold might be?
We don't really know for sure yet because, like I said, the committees haven't actually started doing their work. What we do know is that there is some appetite, including among Democrats, to make sure that those checks are targeted more. There have been some arguments that people who are making more than is maybe necessary to need an additional influx of cash, those people have been receiving checks, and that there's an effort to kind of pare it down to make sure that, as Republicans say, it is targeted relief. Now, there is a debate about who really qualifies as being too high of an income to require such stimulus. And I think we're going to be seeing that play out over the next several weeks. And I think the fact that there was an amendment on this issue, that it got debate, and that, it indicates that this is something that both sides really care about, which means that it is most likely to have a really serious conversation that could drag out for at least the duration of the time that this is in committees.
I see. And did we learn anything more during this process last night about the fate of a plan to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour?
We do know that this is another place where there is, some disagreement among Democrats about the fate of the $15 minimum wage. Some Democrats say that $15 is just not what it should be across the country. They say that maybe in some cities and jurisdictions, $15 is a reasonable minimum wage, but they say that other places in the country, it doesn't need to be quite that high. Now, President Biden has said that it needs to be part of the package. Bernie Sanders, the Budget Committee chairman, says that that needs to be part of the package. So this could be one of those issues that really drags Congress into a fight. We've seen with budget reconciliation's process that they're using that little fights over things that are important policies to some members can drag down entire bills. And this is a policy that is very important to a lot of people. So it could be one of those issues that we see people fighting about for the next several weeks.
Kelsey, I spoke with Senator Tim Kaine earlier this week, and he tried to make the point that this budget reconciliation process could still be bipartisan, even though a final bill likely isn't going to require any Republican support. Based on what you saw last night, is that true? Are Republicans having much of a say in this process?
That is technically true. There have been bipartisan reconciliation bills in the past. But, in this situation, Republicans are starting out at about $600 billion, and Democrats are talking about $1.9 trillion. Bridging that gap and finding bipartisanship on such a big divide would be very difficult to come by.
NPR's Kelsey Snell, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. is ending its support for the war in Yemen. President Biden announced the change yesterday at the State Department.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
Yemen's civil war has been raging for 6 years now, and it's created what the UN calls the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. Barbara Bodine was U.S. ambassador to Yemen from 1997 to 2001. Welcome back to Here and Now.
My pleasure.
We want to understand how the U.S. has helped underwrite this war and what the U.S. involvement has been in Yemen. But first, tell us how it's affected the people who live there, because the civilian toll has been breathtakingly severe.
This war has been a humanitarian catastrophe for the people of Yemen. It is one of the worst famines in the world, with 70 to 80% of the population food insecure, if not at a famine level. It has or had one of the worst cholera epidemics in the world, and it is, of course, now dealing with COVID. This, within the context of a multi-sided civil war that has destroyed the infrastructure, the schools, the clinics, water, and by one UNDP assessment has set the country back 20 years in its development, in 5 years of fighting.
So, as you say, this is a multi-sided war. It's a proxy war. In proxy wars, countries arm and support fighters in another country to achieve their own broader geopolitical goals. As simply as you can, tell us about, on the one hand, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and what Iran, on the other hand, is trying to achieve, all by fostering this fighting in Yemen.
I think it's important to take it back a step, that there was, or there was certainly going to be, a Yemeni civil war. It went up geometrically when the Saudis and Emiratis came in at the end of March 2015 because of their concern about the Houthi insurgency and its connections to Iran. The Emiratis came in, I think, for a slightly different agenda, which was to secure sea lanes. But it's not truly a proxy war. The Iranians are engaged, but not at the level of either fighting directly, as the Saudis and Emiratis do, nor in the level of their support for the Houthi. I would call it a civil war that's been regionalized, rather than calling it a proxy war.
So let's bring it to the U.S. then. Joe Biden says the U.S. will no longer support Saudi Arabia's military campaign in Yemen, including by cutting off arms sales to Saudi Arabia. We should say that U.S. support for this war started under President Obama when Joe Biden was vice president. Why was it worth supporting the effort then but not now?
I think there was a miscalculation under the Obama administration, to be frank, that this could be a very short, quick, and easy war. During the Obama administration, they also were actively involved in trying to find a peaceful negotiated settlement. So it was a little bit of a bipolar policy, but there was a great deal of work on the part of Secretary Kerry to bring the war to an end. Under the Trump administration, there was no effort to try to bring a peaceful solution to this war, and the military support to Saudi Arabia became much more of a blank check.
Well, it apparently won't be under President Biden, but we should say that he is not abandoning Saudi Arabia militarily by any means. He says the U.S. would continue to help the Saudis defend themselves against missile attacks from Iranian-backed forces in the region. Let me just tell you that, by contrast, in the presidential primary debate of 2019, Joe Biden said, "I'll make it very clear we're not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them," meaning Saudi Arabia. "We're going to make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are." What do you make of this contradiction in his statement as a candidate and his pronouncement as president?
Well, I think the recent announcements are far more nuanced. President Biden also announced, and I think it's important to take this beyond just military, that USAID would step up its humanitarian assistance and that we will have a special envoy for Yemen. And further, he made a very clear commitment to support the UN peace efforts. So this is not an abandonment of Saudi Arabia, but it is an effort to shift this to a humanitarian and a negotiated settlement focus.
So with the president's declaration, what happens next? Saudi Arabia says it's going to be working toward a political solution. What's the likelihood of that?
I think we will move towards a political solution now, or at least I think we now are on a path toward a possible political resolution of this. Now, even if the Saudis end all of their operations, it is not going to bring instant peace. And I think what we're going to see is far more of a Saudi Houthi series of talks and arrangements led by the UN, but with the United States far more of an active supporter and facilitator than we've been in the last 4 years.
Barbara Boudin, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. She's now a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Many Americans will be waiting for a while to get a coronavirus vaccine, including some frontline workers, people like grocery store clerks or bus drivers. Many are Black or Latino and have been hit disproportionately hard during the pandemic. And now some are pointing out that they should be getting the shots now. Sam Dancy works at a Westwood Village QFC in Seattle. It's a grocery store owned by Kroger. Sam, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And you're a front-end supervisor who manages workers checking people out at the grocery store. So let me ask you, do you feel safe when you go to work?
Honestly, I want to say not 100%, maybe 50%.
Why?
Well, because first of all, number one, we have a mandate that says that no one should enter the store without masks. Unfortunately, we have some people that disregard that mandate. And it just seems like there's always too many people in the store that just doesn't pay attention to the six-foot rule. Another reason why I think a lot of us probably don't feel safe, because the plexiglass doesn't extend as long as it needs to protect a lot of the associates that are actually checking. And we have not got the vaccination. I think maybe those of us that want to get the vaccination, if we had it, we might feel a little bit safer. I had associated this with going to war, because COVID-19 is like fighting a war. And until they give us all the proper weapons that we need to be able to fight this battle, none of us are going to feel as safe as we have been.
So let me ask you, Sam, you haven't gotten a vaccine yet, but do you have any idea when you will?
No, I don't know as of yet. I'm hoping really
no
soon.
Idea.
They had an itinerary that said maybe February the 3rd, I was in the classification that might be able to. But unfortunately, they haven't been able to keep up with the demand. So we're still waiting.
All right. So make the case. Why should workers like you working in a grocery store, why should they be given priority for a vaccine?
Well, we're on the front line. You know, at one time we were considered heroes. I guess we're now zeros. Also, too, you know, that would make a lot of us give us a better peace of mind. All of us, since we have to go to work under these conditions, they should make these available to all the grocery store workers. If Safeway is getting all these vaccinations next week, Safeway is also part of our Local 21 union. They need to make sure that all the associates that work at Safeway and maybe QFC, the pharmacies, make sure that the associates get their shot so that we're taken care of.
Well, you say we were heroes, but now we're zeros. I think that's – I'm sorry that you feel that way. And I understand you're actually talking to us right now on your lunch break. You're taking time to do that as you're working. So thank you very much.
No problem.
Also want to ask,
I had to go into the bathroom, unfortunately, because the break room, I can't sit here and expect the associates to be quiet. Because that's their break room as well. So hopefully we'll be able to entertain this interview without any more disruptions
in
the background.
Well, that's going above and beyond, Sam. Thank you. So I just want to finally ask you, it must be, or you tell me, is it emotionally exhausting to deal with that uncertainty? Because we've been in this pandemic now for almost a year, and you're going to work every single day, unvaccinated now, not knowing whether or not today is the day that you're going to get COVID.
Exactly. And, you know, not only is that detrimentally physically, but it's also detrimentally mentally. I've been working here since 91, and I started working when the pandemic started. There was a brief time, May 20th, I remember, and it was funny because I couldn't breathe. And the first thing that I thought is that, oh, no, I got COVID. Well, it turned out that I had a bacterial pneumonia. I came back to work after 3 weeks, so I'm happy about that. But that gave me a wake-up call. So when people sneeze or people have a cough, that's the first thing from a mental standpoint that we think, do we have COVID? So that's why it's mentally unsettling.
I'm sure. Sam Dancy works at a Westwood Village QFC in Seattle, a grocery store owned by the Kroger chain. Sam, good luck to you. Stay safe, and let us know if and when you end up getting a vaccine, okay?
I sure will, okay? Thank you very much for taking the time to give me the opportunity to have this platform to speak out for those that don't have the opportunity to speak for themselves.
Sam, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And let's get some more context now. Richard Besser is former acting director at the CDC and president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is an NPR funder. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And when you hear that story of a frontline worker like Sam Dancy, who doesn't have a shot yet, and yet is still going to work every day and is worried about it, what do you think?
I hear him. You know, I think that it's critically important that we recognize that while every community is being hit hard by this pandemic, the burden of this disease is not being felt equally. And those people who need to leave their homes every day to earn money to pay the rent, to make sure that everyone else has food on their table, we need to do all we can to protect them. And when you look at the recommendations that the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices gave to CDC, and you look at the recommendations that came out of the National Academy of Medicine, they, what they said was, after you provide vaccination for healthcare workers and those people in long-term care facilities, that next group after that should be those over 75 because of their great risk, and essential workers. That means people working in supermarkets and teachers and people driving buses. And the one of the other reasons that they made that recommendation is that this pandemic is having a disparate impact on Black Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans, and a disproportionate number of people of color are in jobs that put them at risk every single day, frontline workers.
So maybe this will be a slightly controversial question, but is there an argument that could be made that those frontline workers that you're talking about should actually have always been at the very front of the line, or at least higher in the line, because they are the ones who are going to work every day? And even elderly patients who would be at high risk for this disease at least could stay home, or many of them could stay home. I mean, these are people out literally on the front lines.
Yeah. No, you know, the second group that was recommended was over 75. And what we're seeing in many states across the country is that there was such a push to how many people are you vaccinating every day. Once that becomes the driving factor, then you leave behind those people who are harder to reach. And those are the people who are working all day. Those are the people who can't go to a clinic 9 to 5, may not be able to spend several hours a day looking for a place to get vaccinated, may not have access to broadband. And it takes a little bit more work to get the vaccine to people who are truly at need. You know, the inclusion of people over 75 isn't what's making it so inaccessible to people who are on the front lines. It's a failure to put in the resources to build the systems to meet people where they are. And that is a reflection of decades of underinvestment in our public health system. And it's a reflection on who in America we value and who we do not.
So, I was going to ask you why you think it has taken so long to get to these workers. Is that the answer?
Yeah. You know, if you think about some of the challenges, vaccinating healthcare workers is one of the easiest groups because you can use healthcare facilities. You have people there who are trained to administer vaccines. Getting it out to community clinics is harder. Nursing homes, there again, you have a captive audience, and you can at the state level recognize where those nursing homes are and figure out how to get vaccines to them. But then it gets harder, and you think about, well, how do I reach people who work in supermarkets? How do I reach people who are driving buses? And you have to think, okay, we need different systems. We need mobile clinics. We need phone banks. What would it look like if in America we had a grassroots effort to get people vaccinated, to reach people, to address their concerns for people who have concerns, and we reached people where they were with vaccines? And when you think about the impact of this pandemic, you know, frontline workers, many are more likely to live in households that are multi-generational. There may be someone at home who's at greater risk. So I think that we need to make frontline workers a priority. While we've been able to see that schools can open very safely without vaccination, why not move teachers up in line so that teachers feel more secure in the classroom teaching, so that staff who are working in schools feel more secure and are more secure?
Well, and we have been speaking with both teachers and school superintendents who are starting the vaccination process right now. But that does bring up the issue of, I don't want to say slippery slope, but maybe, because there is a finite amount of vaccines that are available right now. And you could argue that some people are definitely classified as a frontline essential workers and others may not. So where does an Uber driver fit in, for example? Where does an electrical plant worker fit in, or even a reporter at a news organization who has to go out and speak to people outside of the home? Where do you draw the line on frontline workers?
Well, I think that it's really important that there's transparency and openness around the process. I didn't see that when the decision was made to increase vaccination in so many states to people 65 and older. And what we've been seeing in report after report is people from wealthier neighborhoods coming in and taking up appointments in clinics that serve lower income communities. And that's not a fair and just system. When it comes to, well, what occupations should be considered frontline, again, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, the CDC, has a list. These are just recommendations. I'm a doctor, I'm a pediatrician, but I'm not currently seeing patients. So I didn't get vaccinated along with healthcare providers. I'll get vaccinated when my group is called. You know, the miraculous thing is that 1 year into this pandemic, we have two currently approved vaccines that are going into people's arms. And hopefully within a period of 6 months, there'll be enough vaccine for everyone who wants it. But in the interim, we need a system that is fair and just. What we're seeing is a system that is anything but that, where the disparity by race in terms of vaccination is growing and growing. And there's a false narrative that it's because people of color don't want the vaccine. The vast majority of Black Americans, Latino Americans want to get vaccinated, and the systems aren't meeting their needs.
Richard Besser, president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and former acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Besser, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
The U.S. economy showed signs of life after it added 49,000 jobs last month, according to figures from the Labor Department out today. The uptick is a step on the long road to a full economic recovery after employers drastically cut jobs in December. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, to talk about this and news from the auto industry as well. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
Okay, so the economic numbers, do they indicate that the U.S. economy is getting back on track?
I don't think so. I mean, I think they indicate the economy's not in sort of the dire straits it was, say, last spring. But when you look at it, only 49,000 jobs were added in the month of January. That's less than half of what economists had forecast. Remember, we still have almost 10 million jobs to make up from the jobs that were lost during the pandemic. So 49,000 a month is not really going to get us there anytime soon. And the loss of jobs in December was actually revised to indicate 227,000 jobs were lost that month. The unemployment rate did go down, but that's because fewer people were actually participating in the labor force, which is not really a good sign. So, Lisa, I think it shows that, especially for businesses like restaurants and bars and leisure businesses, really are struggling during the winter months when they can't have as much activity outdoors as they do in the spring and the summer.
We'd like to ask you about the auto biz, which has been struggling, especially Ford, which announced it's increasing its investment in electric and self-driving cars through 2025. This is even though it lost $1.3 billion last year as sales fell during the pandemic. Is Ford banking on these investments in self-driving and electric cars to help pull it out of its financial trouble?
I think this is really a race to the future. All the major automakers know that electric vehicles will take on more and more market share. Ford's domestic competitor, GM, is making a big commitment. So Ford wanted to basically say, hey, we're in this race too. We're going to invest $22 billion on electric vehicles in the next few years. And I think it's really all about sort of not getting left behind on that race to the transition to electric vehicles in the future.
Yeah, it says it's coming after General Motors said last week that it's going to phase out most gas-powered vehicles by 2035. So what is holding Ford back from making a similar commitment, and could it be hurting the company in the long run?
You know, Lisa, they were asked about this on their earnings conference call. The chief financial officer, John Lawler, didn't give an exact reason why they're not making that commitment to go all electric by 2035. So my guess is they want to sort of maintain some flexibility and not really get painted into a corner with a commitment like that. But again, that $22 billion investment commitment, that's pretty huge. And it does show, I think it was meant for them to show that they are really taking this seriously.
Really briefly, Ford is scaling back production of its F-150 pickup truck due to a shortage of semiconductor chips that is squeezing the industry. Where is the shortage coming from?
Well, so what happened is demand for autos really slumped during the pandemic, but demand for consumer electronics, you know, phones and laptops and video game consoles, that demand really picked up as people were stuck at home. So the chip makers sort of shifted their focus to those markets rather than autos, and they're kind of still dealing with this imbalance between supply and demand now.
Thank you. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Lisa.
Every year, about 10,000 people in the U.S. need a stem cell transplant, but they can't find a donor. The transplant could help them survive leukemia, lymphoma, sickle cell anemia, and other blood diseases. There's a national registry where people can sign up. It's called Be the Match. But even the registry says most Americans don't know it exists. The mother of a 12-year-old boy with leukemia has set out to change that. Mandy Goldman is a hairdresser who lives with her husband and four children outside Boston. We spoke with her son Mateo, and reporter Linda Matchin, who first told their story in the Boston Globe. Mandy Goldman remembers the day 5 years ago when doctors told her the chemotherapy they gave her son for his leukemia didn't work.
It was Christmas Eve when we got the first phone call where they found that the chemo wasn't working and that they still saw the cancer, which was really devastating news to all of us. They told us that our only option of curing Mateo was a bone marrow transplant. So, you know, we knew that we were talking about a really, really risky procedure that came with a lot of complications, and we had to do it. That was the only option that we had.
Which meant you had to find a close enough match, and it doesn't have to be absolutely precise, but pretty close, which is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. Nobody in the family matched. And I wonder, reporter Linda Matchin, you did this story about Mateo and Mandy and the family. You discovered something in your reporting about Mateo's story, and this is rather shocking, especially given all the medical resources we have in the United States and the people of goodwill in a place like this. What did you find out?
Well, what I found out was that unlike the awareness campaign around donating blood, for example, and there's all sorts of places in which you can donate blood, you see vans parked outside everywhere, there's such an awareness of the need for that, there's almost nothing about the need for bone marrow and stem cell donors. And there is a registry that people can sign up on, but in my opinion, in my experience, nobody really knows about this. Very, very few people are aware of this, and they're certainly not aware of how critical it is to be making donors available For example, there's a little boy right now in North Carolina named Thor Forte, who's 10 and has sickle cell disease. And he has been waiting for literally half his life, 5 years, for a donor to be available. He's a tough match, but they finally did find somebody. And then when the time came for the procedure, the person backed out. So 2 years later, the boy is still waiting.
Mandy, how were you able to eventually find a match? And we should say you didn't find this person in this country.
We were very lucky that we found a match pretty quickly from the registry, a woman from Germany. They were able to make it happen really quickly for us. Just the fact that she was ready to go was a big part of saving Matteo, really.
This is a woman in Frankfurt, Germany. Matteo, you didn't know her name, I believe, at the time, but do you remember writing a note to her?
Yeah, it said, "Dear donor, thank you for giving me the bone marrow. You feel like you're already part of my family." Yeah.
That is such a kind note. And Linda, again, as a reporter, you went to Germany. You met this woman and you saw the note that Matteo was just telling us about. This woman showed it to you. What did it mean to her? And how did she even end up becoming a donor? Because that's a really interesting story.
Her name is Laura Sutherland, and she was in her 20s at the time. And like many young people in Germany, she is aware of this very robust public service campaign to donate bone marrow. There are jingles that you hear on the radio just telling you to swab the inside of your cheek and you can save a life. And she happened to be at a sporting event with her husband, and she was really bored and hungry. So she went wandering around and she came upon a kiosk for one of the many bone marrow registries in Germany. Just 3 months later, she got a call and an email from the registry saying that there is somebody in the United States for whom she could be a match, and was asked if she would donate, and a couple of days later went into the hospital and did the donation.
The donation is put on a plane. The stem cells make their way in a snowstorm to America. Matteo, you received the stem cell transplant. Mandy, how did he do with it and how did things go?
So Matteo was very lucky. The cell started working right away and he was doing well. He did suffer from graft versus host disease, which is a complication of a transplant. So he had stiffness that pretty much took over most of his body. But, you know, Matteo's an amazing kid. So through it all, he was smiling and making the best of it, even though he was suffering for a lot of the time.
So 2 years later, in July of last year, the cancer came back. But since Matteo's first transplant, the science had evolved greatly, so much so that Matteo's older brother, your son Leo, became a candidate to donate his cells. Matteo, tell me what it was like to get that second stem cell transplant, this one from your brother Leo. It's pretty cool, but I do wonder if it means you can never get mad at him ever again.
I didn't realize how I could get my brother's cells. Once that like sank in, I felt that it would connect me and my brother more. And he kids around like, "You have to do whatever I say because I give you his bone marrow."
And do you?
No.
I didn't think so. So, Mandy, just before Christmas, you guys got some great news. What was it?
After your transplant, you get a bone marrow aspirate to see if there's any cancer left over, right down to like the thousandths of a cell. And Matteo had zero cancer in his bone marrow, which was amazing. That was a really big deal.
Absolutely. I know one of the things that you're doing as a result of all this, Mandy, is taking on the role of an activist, trying to raise awareness about stem cell donations. What are you trying to accomplish?
I really want to change the way we talk to our kids about doing something good for somebody else. And when you turn 18, that it's really your duty to get on the bone marrow registry and save somebody else's life. I just feel like as a mother, the amazing feeling Leo got from being able to be the person who saved his brother's life is something he's going to carry with him forever. And even Laura, she gave him 3.5 years of his life that we get to spend with him. And I just really want to educate people about how empowering it is to do something so incredible for somebody else.
I wonder what kind of pushback you get, because if you're tapped as a potential donor, there's much more involved.
Yeah, recently we had a blood drive, and you know, I stayed there all day, and I talked to every person that walked in the door about joining, and I was really surprised about the fear that people had in committing to like get on the list, and that just shook me, because if anybody saw what a kid or any person who's struggling with a life-threatening disease that only has one option for a cure, and you can donate your stem cells by just getting hooked up to a machine like giving platelets or giving blood, and you know, that's nothing compared to the trauma that these kids go through. I mean, Mateo had a drain placed in his stomach while he was awake. He had total body radiation. He had chemotherapy that gave him a rash head to toe, like his skin was burning. Would somebody really say no to like one small day of their life? I just think it's the fear, you know, but once people are educated about how much of a difference it makes, then I feel like they would do it.
Thank you so much for telling us your story. We appreciate it. And Linda Matchin, thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Golden Globe nominations came out this week, and while fans always like to bicker about what standouts should get the attention, there were a number of TV shows with diverse casts and themes that got totally snubbed, including one that received nearly universal acclaim, HBO's I May Destroy You. TV critic Eric Deggans has been busy thinking about this. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So, I May Destroy You. Now, this is a show that broke a lot of ground. It's about a British-born black woman dealing with a very heavy subject, sexual assault. So let's listen to a moment early in the show. The main character, Arabella, calls a friend to try to piece together a night she does not remember.
Why is my head like bleeding? My phone smashed?
I think you fell.
Yeah, you fell. Where's the blood coming from? Where are you bleeding?
It's like my head and...
Is it bad?
No, it's like, yeah, no.
Well, that's good then.
That's all good, all good.
All right, so Eric, you write that I May Destroy You was the consensus pick for NPR media critics and one of the best-reviewed shows of 2020, and yet it did not even get nominated at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, and I think that's problematic for an award show that wants to highlight the best of television. If you somehow miss not only the show, which was this sort of harrowing and really insightful drama, not just about this woman slowly figuring out that she was drugged and sexually assaulted, but also about other people in her orbit who are also struggling with assault in different ways. It aired during this summer when we had the civil rights reckoning over the death of George Floyd, and everyone was looking at television programming and saying, you know, are we seeing authentic depictions of people of color? It's a good example of a huge blind spot where they seem to miss the contributions of people of color, and it's hard to explain why.
Yeah, so that's just one show, but if you look at the nominees for Best Actors and Actresses, they're also very, very white. Only 4 of the 20 actors nominated are people of color, and no black women were nominated for an award. So who do you think is deserving of that honor?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I did a column that was published on NPR.org where I talked about this issue, and I mentioned, you know, names like Journey Smollett and Anjanue Ellis and Wunmi Mosaku from HBO's Lovecraft Country, Ajoa Ando, who played Lady Danbury on Netflix's Bridgerton. Zendaya did some incredible work on a Christmas episode of Euphoria. Uzo Aduba was great at playing Shirley Chisholm on Mrs. America. And then there were men of color who did great work. You know, Lamorne Morris on Hulu's Woke and Sterling K. Brown from This Is Us.
So, Eric, the list is long. I mean, I'm hearing you with this list. It's not like there weren't people to choose
from. I could go on and on and on. Chris Rock was on, you know, Fargo and did a great job. There's just this cavalcade of people of color who did great work last year, and it's baffling.
Wow.
So few of them were recognized.
You know what's kind of odd? I don't know if that's the right word or not, but you're talking about a problem on the TV side of the Globes nominations. And the way this works is that there's also film nominations for the Golden Globes. And this year, they're actually really diverse. So what's going on? Why do you think there's such a contrast between what's happening on the TV and film side of things?
You know, my sense is that the members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association are a little more focused on film anyway. Mm-hmm. And certainly on the film side, you had events like Chadwick Boseman's death that made people sort of hyper aware of the quality of his work in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. You know, Regina King, the director of One Night in Miami, that film just had tremendous buzz. They did a great job in one sense with the directors. You know, they nominated three women for Best Director in Film for the first time ever, but they excluded Spike Lee, who directed again a film that many people were saying was among one of the best films of last year, Defy Bloods. But at least on the film side, they had a lot more performers of color nominated, which somehow they did not manage to do on the TV side.
Well, you're a critic. I mean, you know that in these awards seasons, someone is going to get snubbed every single time, but you've laid out a pretty clear case that something odd is going on, it seems. And I wonder if that has to do with the group that is running the show here. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association, after all, is a very small, very elite group. What do you think? Should they be changing the way they do business here?
Well, what I can say is that when other award shows had problems with diversity or problems with staying relevant in their nominations, the first thing that they did was try to change up and diversify the ranks of their members. This happened with the Oscars. This happened with the Grammys. And I think this has to happen with the Hollywood Foreign Press. They need to understand that their choices are getting more and more out of step with where the mainstream of the industry is and where the TV watching public is. It may sound like I'm obsessing on something that doesn't matter a lot, you know, who cares who wins showbiz awards. But the fact of the matter is these showbiz awards are an important component of the success of a film or a TV show. And it teaches Hollywood what can be successful and what may not be successful. So if you want to see more TV shows about people of color, more diversity in the TV space, you have to look to these award shows and say, you got to be more inclusive when people do great work so that we can see more of it.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
All right. Same to you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.